It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll meet violinist Don Gingrich. She's the new concertmaster for Orchestra Iowa. And we'll also talk with Barney Sherman of IPR Classical about growing gender parity in the world of classical music. But first, best-selling author Michael Perry is well known for his humorous memoirs about rural living in Wisconsin. He's a musician, a comedian, a radio host, and he dabbles in farming. He's also now a novelist. His first novel is called The Jesus Cow, and he is with us today. Hello, Michael.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, appreciate you having me.
What inspired you to turn to fiction after having so much success in nonfiction writing?
Well, there was some hesitation because I'm a respecter of genre. I don't think you can just skip from one to the other, and I also have pretty good awareness of my own limitations. But I had started with, last year I released a book called The Scavengers, which was fiction for a younger audience. And then as long as I was in that mode, I'd carried this idea around for a long time that became the germ of The Jesus Cow. And so I asked my editor if they'd let me write a novel, and she said yes. So I took off from there.
Well, you introduced this germ of an idea. You introduce it right away in the book. So maybe you could read us a little bit from the beginning of The Jesus Cow to give us an idea of what's going on.
Yeah, I'll read the prologue and then just a couple of lines from chapter one. So this is the prologue. On Christmas Eve itself, the bachelor Harley Jackson stepped into his barn and beheld there, illuminated in the straw, a smallish newborn bull calf, upon whose flank was born the very image of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Well, said Harley, that's trouble. So that's the prologue, and Harley has this friend Billy, and Billy's a decorated combat veteran, but a reclusive fellow, lives in a trailer with a bunch of cats, and he likes to consider himself a homegrown philosopher, and he's always trotting out little lines of wisdom that he professes to be his own, although if you pay close attention, he's actually just quoting Waylon Jennings' lyrics. And so whenever Harley needs some consultation, he calls Billy over. So now this is just a couple of lines. The name of the cow that had the calf, her name is Tina Turner, and it's explained in Chapter 1 why they chose that name. Billy wanted to honor Tina Turner. And so now this is just what's happening as the two men are watching. Now, as the two men watched, Tina Turner licked her calf from stem to stern, clearing the last of the amniotic fluid. At the moment, Billy was unable to see the image of Jesus, his view being blocked broadside by Tina. Then the cow laid on an especially aggressive lick, and the calf stumbled into the open. The hair across its rib cage was slicked and whorled, but even thus distorted, there was no mistaking the image made manifest. You got the Son of God there, bud, said Billy, with a cowlick. This was a stylized Jesus, rendered in black and white splotches like clip art from the cover of a 1970s family planning brochure, but immediately recognizable as the standard doe-eyed Lutheran hippie iteration. Harley looked up at his friend. What do you think? Get a lawyer, said Billy, and start printing T-shirts. So that pretty much sets up the rest of the book.
Right. Now, you said you'd been carrying around that germ of an idea for a long time. Where did that come from?
Believe it or not, a coffee shop in Nashville, Tennessee. I used to go to Nashville fairly often, and I'd write down there in this coffee shop called Bongo Java. And for a long time in Bongo Java, when you went to pay for your coffee, underneath the cash register there, they had this little illuminated glassed-in shrine. And inside the shrine was a cinnamon bun that was said to resemble the likeness of Mother Teresa. And indeed, it did look a little bit like Mother Teresa, although, as I always said, it always helped if you knew ahead of time it was supposed to look like her. And they called it the nun bun. And they sold T-shirts and coffee mugs with the nun bun on them, at least they did until Mother Teresa's lawyers got in contact and had to stop doing that. To be fair to Mother Teresa, she didn't care about them having fun with her likeness. She just didn't want anyone making money off it. And then in 2005, someone broke into Bongo Java in the dead of night and stole the nun bun. It was said at some point to have resurfaced in Seattle, but those of us who follow the issue closely believe that one's a fake. But anyway, there's this whole idea, and there's a word, and I know how to spell it, and I know what it means. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, but it's called pareidolia, which is where your mind works in such a way that when you see a group of disparate images or spots or dots, your mind tries to make sense out of them. And so it is that almost weekly now, whipping around the internet is a picture of a grilled cheese sandwich where someone thinks they see the image of Christ, or there's some moisture on a concrete wall and people think they've seen the Virgin Mary. And so it was that idea of pareidolia, and that on the one hand, this is clearly a comic novel over the top, supposed to be silly and hopefully funny, but it's based on something that's very common. And it's the books about what we want to believe and what we want to see. And so I thought, well, as a farm kid, I grew up milking cows and on a little Wisconsin dairy farm, cleaning calf pens, and we had Holsteins, and some of them had unusual spots, and we even named one of our cows Trigger because she had a spot on her forehead that looked like the trigger of a gun. And so I just thought, well, what if a guy, just a bachelor in a small town who's raising a couple of beefers and has one milk cow, goes out on Christmas Eve and his cow has given birth to this calf with a spot that could be construed to be the face of Christ, and what would happen next?
Well, and Harley doesn't take Billy's advice. He doesn't start printing T-shirts, and he doesn't call a lawyer. I found it really interesting, the juxtaposition from, I mean, Harley doesn't really know what to do, and he's pretty ambivalent about the whole thing. But the juxtaposition of him thinking about how his mother would have handled this situation and how things like this play out in the 21st century, was that part of what you wanted to do, was to give us that contrast?
Sure. I mean, the book is dedicated to the quiet ones, because, you know, we live in such a noisy world and things flying back and forth on the internet, and everything seems to be clear cut. You're either good or bad, red or blue, whatever, all that kind of stuff. And so I was raised in an obscure fundamentalist Christian sect, and that sounds kind of freaky and scary. I'm not part of it anymore. I'm a bumbling agnostic with traces of amateur existentialism, is how I describe myself. But in fact, I had a wonderful childhood. My parents are still part of that faith, and they are very quiet people, very humble people. And so there is nuance even to those things. And so I thought it would be fun to try to deal with his first instinct. His mom, and I think a lot of people, whether your parents were religious or not, if you're from the Midwest, you'll recognize this quote. His mom was always say, well, let's not make a scene. You know, that's kind of the big Midwestern thing. And so at first, Harley doesn't want to show this calf to anyone. But then, as you said, in this age, the calf gets out, someone gets a photo of it, and it goes, in the parlance of the day, it goes viral. And then things are really out of his hands.
The his first thought was, you know, if this had happened when Mom was alive, she would have went and got the shoe polish out.
Yeah, when I grew up, we had a tin of Kiwi black shoe polish in the drawer, and the only time we polished our shoes was before going to church. And so I had this image of his mom. Yeah, the first thing she'd do is grab that Kiwi shoe polish and get out there and scrub black shoe polish into the image so that no one could recognize it. But, of course, even that begs the question, do you really rub out the face of what may be Christ, you know?
Well, it seems like, as you said, the idea of the image of Jesus Christ or one of these holy images appearing in a surprising place is something that actually happens in real life, although having it on the side of a calf and be so obvious that everyone who looks at this calf can see it without question is pretty fantastical. But you also created such an incredibly real town with such believable characters. Was that also part of your hope to sort of juxtapose the fantasy against a town that anybody who spent any time in the rural Midwest would recognize?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, again, I can't stress enough, it's supposed to be a comic novel, so one takes certain liberties for humor. But yes, I want to, this is where I grew up. This is where I still live. It's a fictitious town, but of course it's drawn on my experience. And, you know, one of my favorite things to talk about on book tour was Harley's a bachelor, But there are several female characters in the book, several women who are very independent. And my favorite little moment of Midwestern independence is that Harley goes to the gas station, and he is looking for a girlfriend. He's not a swinging bachelor or anything, but he's always in the market, and he gets some coffee, and he turns around, he bumps into this woman, and he spills coffee all over her boots. And the thing that really gets his attention is that when he looks down, he notices that when the boots, when the coffee hit her boots, that A, they're good, sturdy work boots, and B, the coffee beaded up on the leather. So he knows that she takes good care of her boots, and this speaks to him. And you know, I came from a place where, I remember writing a book. I wrote a book called Truck, A Love Story, and there was a lot of discussion with the folks in New York. They were so concerned about having a truck on the cover and that in the title, and they came right out and said, we don't think women, you know, how are we going to get women interested in this book? And I just said, man, you apparently don't come from where I come from. That's not a problem. And indeed, that book, I get more emails from women about that book, really, frankly, than men. And so I liked the idea of just going to my local gas station in my small hometown and saying, yeah, that person could be in the book. That person could be in the book. You're definitely drawing on your own experience for these things, and then hopefully giving it a humorous twist.
And of course, having the gas station in this little town be the social hub of the community is also something a lot of us can relate to.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a little line in there about how that, you know, everyone grumbled because when the convenience store came to town, it was one of the things that pushed out the local grocery store. But then, of course, everybody winds up in the same line with their gas station coffee and their ham crisp sandwich.
Right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with best-selling author Michael Perry. He has just released his first novel for grown-ups. It's called The Jesus Cow. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll meet violinist Dawn Gingrich. She's the new concertmaster for Orchestra Iowa in Cedar Rapids. That's coming up in about 15 minutes. With me right now is best-selling author Michael Perry. He has just released his first novel. It's called The Jesus Cow. And in the book, in the very beginning of the book, a bachelor farmer in a very small town in Wisconsin, his dairy cow produces a calf that has the image of the Son of God on its side, and that's where things get going. Michael, could you read a little bit for us from another part of the book, introduce us to the town and other characters?
Sure. One of the things about, you know, obviously I was mildly nervous about writing this book, and especially the title, but
And you also brought this calf into the world on Christmas Eve. So,
yeah.
So it's not just the image of Jesus, but also a holy day.
Some would say heavy-handed, but what are you going to do? It's a novel. So there's one character in here who's a very quiet woman of faith. And as I said early in the interview, I'm an agnostic, but I've had a couple of people in my life, three people in particular, who are elders in the community, and they're people of great faith, but quiet faith. And I always admired that, even if I don't share the same faith. And so I wanted a character in the book who was like that. And so there's this widow, and I'll just read a little section that introduces her. She owns her own salvage yard, by the way, and runs her own car crusher. Christmas morning broke to the rumble of a junk truck. Margaret Magdalene Jankowski came downshift and off the overpass and past the old water tower she had hoped to scrap, her split-shift Ford straight truck squatting to the overloads beneath the weight of a dismantled combine. Meg was ninja-grade with a blowtorch, a rusted Harrow, and a flattened Ford Festiva, the snug balance of the load testament to the fact that this was a woman who knew her way around ratchet straps and chain boomers. The truck pulled into the quick pump, and Meg, a slight and nimble widow in a watch cap and greasy coveralls, jumped out to pump the fuel. After paying cash for the gas, Meg turned left out of the lot and drove the truck a block into swivel, pulled a U-turn, and parked along the curb in front of St. Jude's Church. St. Jude's Catholic Church. Most days she would disappear into the chapel for 10 minutes, where she would light a votive candle, pray a decade of the rosary, then reemerge to return up the road past the water tower, recross the overpass, and hang a left down the southbound ramp for Clearwater in the scrap metal processing center. But today was Christmas. When Meg dismounted from the truck and walked across the St. Jude's parking lot past the concrete Virgin Mary sheltering beneath the protruding half of a vintage bathtub buried in the vertical, she was carrying her best dress hung and sheathed in dry cleaner's plastic. Today the truck would sit parked all day long at the curb as Meg assisted Father Carl in the celebration of both Christmas morning masses. She was weary, having returned from midnight mass only a few hours previously, and prior to that, having spent Christmas Eve day dissecting the combine, tamping down the festiva, and loading the truck. But for Meg, devotion trumped all. St. Jude's Catholic Church was nothing fancy. No soaring arches like the church in Boomler. No frescoes, no life-size, lifelike, bleeding, and bethorned Christ mannequin nailed to a towering cross of solid plaster. Rather, the crucifix that hung above Father Carl during services was punched from polished brass, the suffering son represented in abstract fashion, his halo formed of tack-welded wire. St. Jude's had been constructed in the late 1960s from blueprints composed by an architect apparently heavily influenced by early brutalism and post-war basement rec room. The exterior was done up in concrete and browns, and the interior ran heavily to blonde paneling. The pews were padded with naugahyde. The carpet was a close-nubbed tan and mustard-striped affair, the texture of a polyester pot scrubber, and the figurines representing the stations of the cross hung on their plaques like dated bowling trophies, the mustachioed, long-haired disciples looking like gentle folk rockers. In short, you could imagine Michelangelo giving the whole works half a star. There were no bells in the belfry, rather a set of metal horn speakers hidden in a cupola that blared out tape-recorded chimes. But every single time Margaret Magdalene Jankowski stepped through the doors of St. Jude's, dipped her fingertips in the holy water, and crossed herself, she thought, no, felt, only one word, sanctuary.
That's Michael Perry reading from his novel, The Jesus Cow. One thing that I'm really struck by, Mike, in the book, it's a very funny book. And so often when in modern satire, people are belittled. There's a meanness to a lot of modern satire. And in this book, everybody has a redeeming characteristic.
I hope I didn't interrupt your question.
No, go on.
Because I owe an Iowa writer some thanks over that very particular point. There are two characters in the book who were quote-unquote the villains. That's a little strong for what they are. One is a developer, includes Sorensen, who's always struggling with his CPAP mask. And then there's a woman named Carolyn, who is a disgraced university professor. And she wound up in the small town trying to recover after her career came off the rails. And when I first wrote that, the sections about Carolyn, I wrote about how she ran afoul of the Academy and how she was somewhat hung in her own net. As a matter of fact, she ran afoul of a speech code that she herself had written. And when I sent it to a friend, a guy named Dean Bacopoulos, who's a novelist, he's got a novel out right now called Summerlong, and he teaches at Grinnell in Iowa. And we've known each other off and on for years, and I just said, could you just look at these passages, because I'm not a guy from the Academy, and I wanted to get those details right. And when he wrote back, he said, you know, it's funny, you made me laugh, I know what you're trying to do, but he said, you have to let her up, you have to give her some air, and you have to, you know, she was not this person in the beginning. In the beginning, all she wanted to do was teach and share poetry and literature and make the world a better place, so you have to let us know how she came to be at this other point. And boy, I went back then and rewrote the parts about Carolyn and the parts about Clute. And I think, I hope, for the better, and thanks to Dean Bacopoulos' advice. And so I agree, especially with religion. You know, as I said, I'm not a believer myself, but I grew up a believer. And yeah, I know what it's like to be on the end of being belittled. And I just think, I do reserve the right to find humor in all things, religion included. But I think a guy tries not to be too vicious. There's plenty of that in the world.
Well, it's funny when you said there were two villains in the book. Of course, I immediately thought about Clute, this developer who's trying really hard to get everybody's land. He's trying to close down Harley's farm, and he's trying to get Meg's junkyard closed down so he can put a hotel on that land. And he spends a lot of time shouting at people and filing lawsuits and going bankrupt. But when you said two villains, it took me a moment because, I mean, Carolyn really is written in a sympathetic way. You can see that she's really messed up her life, but she was pretty likable.
Yeah, and again, that's really due to the input I had from Dean Bacopoulos, and I just think that she's still funny. I can still we can still land all the shots that were landed originally, but everybody has more dimension, and so you do your best. Goodness knows I need grace, big truckloads of it. So,
when you said two villains, though, the other person that I thought of actually was Father Carl, because he gets really caught up in the Jesus Cow movement, and for a while,
or Reverend Gary.
Oh, Reverend Gary. I'm sorry,
yeah, Reverend Gary of the Church of the Roaring Lamb.
Oh, never mind. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
I'm confusing my church leaders here in my memory.
Yeah, Reverend Gary. Even Reverend Gary, though, has a moment right at the end where Harley gives him a little space to operate. But there's at least one scene where Harley has to really come down hard on Reverend Gary and just say, you need to back off because he has this gigantic crucifix and it's. Turns out that it's quite literally dangerous for him to be waving that thing around. Yeah, I think Reverend Gary comes more from the, again, as a guy who I was raised a fundamentalist, so I know the Bible and I know good people from within that. But I also know, I always say, man, I've changed my mind on a lot of things over the course of my life, and they needed changing, but it never happened because of a bumper sticker or because somebody hectored me. It was always someone being patient with me and just giving me the information I needed and helping me, waiting for me to come around. So Reverend Gary is kind of that guy where he just wants to push you into getting saved.
You have written a lot of nonfiction over the years and, portrayed people that you live among in the nonfiction. Have you ever gotten any backlash from that, from the your neighbors?
So here's the neat thing about that question when you're on tour for a novel, because yes, short answer, there have been a couple of instances where people have been upset with me, usually been able to resolve it. But counterintuitively, perhaps, it's far more difficult to deal with people's feedback on the novel, because when you're writing nonfiction, people can very clearly see, oh, that's the local butcher. We all know him. We all recognize him. When you write a novel, then you get this thing where people go, why did you write that about me? And they say, well, it's not about you. It's fiction. But no, I can tell that's about me. Or if your mom calls in tears, she goes, why do you say these things about me? And you go, it's not you, mom. It's a fiction. Oh, I know it's about me. And so you can actually, I think I never really understood the concept of projection until I wrote fiction. So I would submit that counterintuitively, perhaps, it's far harder to write novels and convince people that it's not about them than it is to deal with the few folks who maybe have a little axe to grind over something you wrote in real life.
Well, and I know a lot of novelists kind of struggle with the fact that people assume that everything in a novel is true and about the writer. And you and Harley have quite a few things in common.
Yeah, and I was, before I went on tour, I thought I was smarter than I was, which is a fairly regular occurrence with me. But I said, I know I'm going to get the question. People are going to say, oh, how much of this is true? And I'm just going to look them right in the eye, and I'm going to say 27%. And then I'm going to refuse to answer any other questions. But, of course, that's not how it works, because you have to discuss it. And of course, you draw on your own experience. I draw on my own experience as a small-town guy. The local volunteer fire department plays a critical role in this book twice. Once in helping things go horribly wrong, and once in quite literally saving people's skin. So that obviously, I went to fire meetings. I did training on blevy explosions, which become a critical part of the book. And so Yeah, you draw from your own experience. But then what I love about the fiction is being able to just, and here's where I had to apologize to my novelist friends. They'd always talk about how they let their characters take over, and I'd say, yeah, whatever, you know, welcome to your MFA. And then I started writing fiction, and in The Scavengers, the protagonist of that book is a 12-year-old girl. And at some point, about chapter four, I had to just shut up and let her do the talking. And it's the same with the Jesus Cow. You get to know the characters, and then pretty soon you let them tell you where to go. And like I said, I have to apologize to all my novelist friends because I used to make fun of them for talking like that. But the beauty, what I was trying to say, is that I just love the freedom of letting people say whatever the characters say whatever they want to say and not having to fact check it. That's rather lovely.
So you mentioned the volunteer fire department. You have spent a lot of years working for the volunteer fire department in your community. Was that fun for you to fictionalize that and give people a window into it?
Yes, it was fun because A, you know, you, as I said, you could ramp up the humor, but B, anybody who served in a small or rural volunteer service will also realize that a guy didn't really have to ramp up the humor too much. A lot of that could be lifted right out of just about any department out there. But yes, that was fun, and it was really fun. I can't get into it too much because it gets into spoiler territory, but there's a specific sort of training we had. And to be able to think back to when I actually went through that training with my hometown crew, people I went to school with, people I was on the fire department for 12 years, and we went through that training, and then to extrapolate from that real-life experience and then say, well, what if X happened and we had to respond? What would we do? And my favorite part was writing about how they decided that once the Jesus Cow started to go viral, they figured they could use it for a fire department fundraiser. And they, because how hard could it be? It couldn't be any harder than running the beer tent. And so they gave it a shot, and things did not go well.
So when I introduced you, I mentioned that you're a musician, you're a radio host, you're a writer, a number of other things as well. And we have a question from one of our listeners, Steve, who wants to know how many people think that you are the spiritual descendant of Garrison Keillor.
I don't know. I get that question now and then. I've never met Mr. Keillor. I did when I was starting out here. I read a book about how he got started, and I just realized that he went and worked really hard and did whatever it took. And so I've sort of always approached that. I stumbled into this. I have a nursing degree, and I grew up on a dairy farm, and I never planned any of this. And so I couldn't be more grateful. Writing comes first. Writing's at the core of it, the books, and I do still quite a bit of magazine writing. If I don't pay attention to the writing, the rest of it falls away. But I also learned years ago that if I was going to survive as a writer in this day and age with some of the changes that are going on, I'd probably have to find ways to build off the writing. And so I do a lot of speaking and performing, and I started a little band, and we signed a little record deal, and we do just well enough that it's worth our while to play 10 or 15 shows a year. And I don't know. I grew up watching my dad farm. He just got up every morning. He went out and he milked the cows. Nobody was applauding. He just had to milk the cows because they weren't going to do it themselves. And so I've always, I'm hesitant to say talk too much about it because it starts to sound pretty cornball, but it really is. I feel so lucky to be part of the arts world. It blew my doors off at a fairly late age. I was out of college, and I just feel so grateful to be in the company of writers and musicians and readers and listeners.
You're also a dad now, and you've still got your hand in all of these different worlds. How do you find the balance?
Well, I go back to my nurse's training and my long experience with EMS. You just operate by triage. What has got to be done right now? Like last night, there was a newspaper column due this morning, so I was up till 2 this morning finishing that because it had to get done, and there were other things that came up during the day. But even there, I'm always hesitant to talk too much about that because everybody's got that. We're all facing our own path to survival, whether we've got 8 kids or no kids, whether we're self-employed or whether we're holding down a job. Everybody's, in this day and age, we're all just doing what we can to hang on.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Hey, I really appreciate it. And if folks want to know more, I do have a website, sneezingcow.com. And thanks so much for having me on. Iowa's been very good to me. I sneak over the border whenever I can.
Well, we're always happy to have you. Michael Perry, his new novel, his first novel, is called The Jesus Cow. And again, his website is sneezingcow.com. Coming up in just a moment, we'll meet the new concertmaster for Orchestra Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.